listening to the AI in Motion podcast with JP Morgenthau. Hi, everyone. I'm JP Morgenthau. I'm the host of AI in Motion. Today, we have a guest with us, Dr. Matthew Alberts. Dr. Alberts is an executive leader with over 18 years of experience driving innovation through AI, machine learning, and digital transformation across energy, manufacturing, and automotive sectors. He currently leads the emerging technology group at a major electric utility, where he helps operationalize AI and technology to improve safety, efficiency, and sustainability at scale. Matthew holds a PhD in industrial engineering with published research on predictive analytics, reinforcement learning, and real-time optimization systems. So hopefully it is going to be very relative to people who actually operate in supply chain environments and manufacturing environments. And most of all, he is a published author, or will be by September, when his book, Gen AI Manufacturing Revolution, will be released. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it. I'm really excited about the conversation today. We had a really good intro conversation when we first met, and exciting for what that will produce for the podcast. Matthew, you want to just take a few minutes? I mean, we did the intro, but, you know, just talk about your daily life. Like, you know, how does your knowledge, you know, that with regard to both the AI and the industrial engineering come together in a real world picture for you in a day-to-day environment?
Well, first of all, JP, thank you for having me on here. It's great to be here. Love that we can continue the conversation that we kicked everything off with and share some great information with all your listeners out there. But yeah, that's a great question to kick things off with. I don't think many people would start in that space. I appreciate you starting there. You know, for me, it's primarily around a mantra of, you know, I think if you were in sales, right, the mantra of always be selling or ABC, always be closing. Well, for me, it's always be learning, right? It's learning and listening. So starting my day off, right, it's not to where I go to a certain website. I'm not going to LinkedIn. I'm not going to look at the latest article on TechCrunch or anything like that, right? It's really around listening and learning to family, to friends, to acquaintances, to colleagues on calls, trying to go through different parts of businesses, right? I work in a large electric utility right now. So obviously we have so many different groups that, you know, I don't want to inject myself in. I want to go listen. I want to hear how they're working. I want to understand different things. You know, I'll give the example of, you know, this is probably about 7 or 8 years ago, but let me give you the example of something that hit with me. And is, you know, my father worked for a major airlines as an aircraft mechanic. He did that for 43 years. Well, about a few years before he was ready to retire, the airline, you know, you have shift work for your mechanics, right? A shift, B shift, C shift, you know, first, second, third, however you want to do it. They have 24/7 coverage at the airport as an aircraft mechanic. Well, what they saw, typical shift was, you know, 6:37 to 2:30, 3:30 in the afternoon. That would be considered your A shift. And as you build up seniority, that's usually the shift you work, right? That's considered your A shift, your first shift. When you start out, you're working the midnight shift, right? The graveyard shift. Just like, you know, many industries, that's where you start out.
Earn your dues, man. Work your way.
We all have to do it, right? You know, crawl through industrial equipment, get dirty, get dirty, sweat, right? Like, well, you know, what the airline saw was an issue with third shift not getting the airplanes ready to go out for their first flights in the morning. So, you know, typically
they were the most important, and they were treated as the janitorial cleanup crew.
Well, you know, most major airports, right, your last airplanes are coming in, you know, 11, 12, midnight, maybe a little bit after midnight. And you usually have a gap of no planes leaving from, you know, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m., right? Well, your first planes are going out 5:30, 6:30, right? That's when your first planes are leaving. You have time to get those airplanes ready to go out, right? Fix any issues, address any maintenance things, right? In addition to you cleaning it and everything, refueling, right? Well, what they found out was through natural attrition, through retirement, right? You're hiring younger, less skilled folks. Those folks are now on, you know, your third shift. They weren't getting the planes ready to go out in the morning.
They weren't as experienced.
So, you know, what does the airline do? Oh, not upskill third shift. They roll back first shift. So now all of a sudden, my dad had to go in at 3:30 in the morning.
Right.
So now first shift is starting earlier.
So right? Your seniority is worth nothing because you have this awful schedule because they need your skills.
So that you know, personally didn't sit with me well, right?
I like that.
Because just like that, it's like, well, that's not how you treat your most senior people. Like, let's come up with a better way that they could work. Well, the at the time, the industry I was in, pulp and paper manufacturing industry, similar concept, but instead of having like a less skilled, we had less staff on third shift, right? You're running a 24/7 production facility. You don't have all the support staff then at third shift. So when something breaks at 2 a.m, 3 a.m, who's getting called out? Your maintenance manager, your maintenance staff, your technicians.
Yeah, there's a lot of involvement. The whole asset management. Where is this part stored? How am I getting it from point A to point B? And it's 2:30 in the morning, and I was hired 6 weeks ago.
Well, and guess what? We don't live 5 minutes down the road from these facilities, right? Like we 40 minutes away, an hour away. So hey, if a plant goes down at 2 or 3 in the morning, it's now an hour or two before you just get the people on site to actually see the problem.
Yep.
And as much as you want to think like this is going to be, it's a 10 minute fix. It's a 20 minute fix. It's knowing the right information. It's knowing where, like you said, where the part is or the right way to get the part accessed or how to reset the machine. Right.
And in some cases you won't actually even know until the pilot gets there. Right. Because you need a pilot to like get in there and do their checks before you can confirm that your maintenance correction was actually took and did what you expected.
Right. So, you know, I took what I saw my dad go through in the airline industry and saw how, where it had correlation over in the industry I was in and thought about, okay, what's the right piece of technology that we could deploy in this scenario? Right. And this was just about before we had the advent of, if you've ever heard the term connected worker, right? Connected worker was not a term back when this was, when we were doing this. And so we thought, okay, how do you get the remote expert into the field?
Great. Yeah.
Now, you know, obviously it's about listening to colleagues, having connections, having relationships. So had a relationship with a remote support staff at Lockheed, where they were using a remote expert platform to allow them to communicate out to mechanics across the world, right? To give real-time engineering support to those mechanics as they need to fix military planes. And if you can imagine, getting a military plane back up and running as fast as you can in some scenarios is very important. So now we can't fly those experts. Again, why you're an expert? Well, we don't have 1,000 experts on one piece of machinery, right? Especially when you need an expert on landing gear, on engines, on cockpit, on wing. So, you know, so having that remote support staff that can stay in a central location and now all of a sudden support so many mechanics in a vast geographical place as far as like reaching so many military bases across the world is not unlike how we have in manufacturing and most businesses. We have so many different facilities. And so when we want to say, okay, it's great if we can have 30-year people at every one of those facilities. It's great if we can have, you know, deep SMEs across every bit of process at each facility. But guess what? We don't. People have retired. People have changed jobs. We've gone through we centralized resources. We've dispersed resources. We've centralized resources. Like that whole cyclic game has gone on.
Yeah, it's never a perfect mix, right?
And so, you know, thinking about how these other companies are starting these like remote operation centers, I wanted to bring in the ability for staff to support facilities remotely. So when you get the call at 2 a.m, you don't have to go to the facility. You get out of bed, you pull up your phone, you turn your computer on. Think of it as industrial FaceTime,
right?
I'd love to say they use FaceTime, but guess what? We don't have great Wi-Fi in manufacturing facilities, right? Or it's not optimized, right? FaceTime's not optimized to work in low bandwidth situations. I can't telestrate on the screen. I can't pull documents. I can't send pictures. So think of it as like that industrial
FaceTime. It's funny. It's actually the background. I came from some degree. I came out of Ray's Carrier telestration, remote desktop sharing telestration. It was one of the applications I built. And then a couple of years later, like maybe 8 years later, I was doing the equivalent of what we would now call Teams collaboration. And our trial, our big customer, was General Motors around line stoppages. And it's along the same ideals. But, you know, just real quick, the story you told, I was just scrolling. And something caught my attention as a reel. I was scrolling reels on Facebook, and this one story about this guy. He's like, I got fired from Disneyland, and I'm like, this sounds interesting. I want to hear what happened here. Got fired from Disneyland because he was a busboy at a restaurant right on Main Street, and he's like, if you by the time you get everyone out of the park, your job is the overnight shift is to get the restaurant ready for the morning run. And he's like, and if you have the wrong team with you in there, you're not getting out till 3-4 in the morning. And he's like, I just had it. And I just collected all the dirty dishes and I put them in a cart and I took them over to Jungle Cruise and I threw them in the water. And the next morning when they turned the ride on, the first two boats out got stopped because a ladle was fucking the tracks. But it made me think of that, overnight team, right? That responsible, so important for getting things ready. And yet we often do delegate that to the least experienced people because there's a natural conundrum, right? It's like the best people don't want to work those hours typically, right? And unless you're Henry Winkler in Night Shift and you want to escape the real world, Wall Street world you're living and just be by yourself at the end of the night and work the morgue for Night Shift. But, most people aren't like that. So, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting problem, though, Maine. And I can see how it started to pull you into being predictive and proactive around information.
Well, it's just that. It's like, think of like how we have to, not just that third shift now, but as we have less skilled people in the workforce, right? And it's no fault of their own. They just, it takes time to gather skills and stuff. We have to upskill them. And what's different ways we upskill them? Well, I think of it's not that I'm a fan of always saying this, right? But it's people, processes, and technology, right? And when you think about, I lose a 30, 40 year person, it's not just their knowledge of the equipment, it's their knowledge of the company, their processes, their contacts. Right. I bring somebody in that maybe he's only been there 3, 4, 5 years, right? That knows some of what, but like you can't directly duplicate that knowledge and experience that just left. So one thing is, how do I keep them, maybe say, okay, go retire, but we have this connected worker platform, this remote, expert platform that if we have to call you, hey, you can answer from your right. boat when you're fishing, right?
Right.
Hopefully we don't call you when you're sitting up in the deer blind or anything like that. But we have access to you still. But you think about what do we need to put in place for those, less experienced folks that are coming into positions? How do we upskill those positions? As we know, AI is coming on board to so many companies very, very rapidly, some more rapidly than others, but that changes the way we have to work. So it's all about, we know we're going to have less people on the floor, right? More robotics, AGVs, right?
It's such an interesting problem domain that you're attacking here with AI. I think so many people, my expectations are they're going to get in and start talking about, I'm using AI for procurement and analyzing my contracts. I'm using AI to look at my just-in-time delivery patterns and my suppliers. Are they delivering on time? What would happen if I had a disruption here? How would I, tell me, using AI to dynamically reroute or reselect, different suppliers based on their ability to backfill if I have an immediate emergency. And you're coming in saying, no, and tell me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like you're coming in saying, no, to me, AI, the first and most important thing is being able to capture and make relevant the knowledge base, build the knowledge base. It's the most important piece.
That's such a critical piece because we are losing that knowledge so rapidly, right? And I still don't know there's a perfect system of saying, hey, JP, if you told me, hey, I'm retiring in 2 weeks, right? Like with anybody's right to do, right? 2 week notification. You say, hey, Matt, I'm retiring 2 weeks. And I say, oh, man, quick, JP, put on this headset, log into the system, and keep doing your job. But we're gonna download all the information from your brain, right? We don't have anything like that yet. So, again, it's like it's you have bits and pieces of, hey, let's get a knowledge chapter. Or, hey, JP, wear this GoPro now when you go do your tasking for the next week. And we'll at least have a video of how you do it because – you do it the best, or you do it the most efficient, or, and I don't know if you're cut corners when you do it. That's why you do it an hour faster than everybody else, or
right.
You've just gotten the hand motion down to where you're doing whatever task you're doing.
But in that 2 week window, you have to hope they hit the majority of tasks that you want from them. And it could be seasonal. It could be, well, we missed our window. We won't get the opportunity to see Jim go through this for another 4 weeks. Right. So,
well, you know, in that scenario, I'd say it's like it's almost the too little too late mantra. And I think of it too, you know, the numbers I saw a few days ago, what it said, 98% of companies out there are doing something with AI.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know what the 2% are, but like, I don't think they'll be a company for very, very much longer if they're not doing something with AI.
Well, of that 98%, and I've looked into some of this research, I actually posted about it on LinkedIn. A good majority of them it's like the early cloud days when people were saying they were doing cloud, and what they had done was move their Outlook server into Office 365, right? I'm AI, I'm using ChatGPT, or I'm using Copilot. And you can't say they're wrong. The problem is they're technically accurate in their statement, but they're not achieving any real advancement right.
And that's it. It's like 20% of companies are actually achieving some type of advancement with AI. And you go down even to a smaller percentage than that, you're thinking less than 5% of companies out there are moving a needle.
Innovating,
right?
Yeah.
They're truly innovating, truly changing the way they work, truly providing value. And I think it's that value piece that we're missing right now is we're inundated with AI, right? Everywhere we look, it's generative AI, it's LLMs, it's agentic AI now, it's quantum computing, neural network, right? We're inundated with
it. A buddy of mine who, Alan Schimmel, who does the TechStrong TV, I do the TechStrong gang with him occasionally, and in the morning it's like five of us on, you know, talking about a couple of topics. And AI continually comes up now, and he's like, I'm starting, and he's from New York. We grew up in Rosedale, New York, in the same neighborhood, right? So we're from the old neighborhood, you know, the old neighborhood. So he's like, you know, with AI, I'm starting to feel like when I was young and I used to go to Manhattan and somebody would open the coat and go, you want to watch? You want to watch? So, yeah, I get it, man. It's definitely, it's starting to feel like that. Am I wrong?
No, you're exactly right. I mean, you think, you know, every day there is a new company doing something with AI, right? Whether they're an AI company or now they're software that's applying AI, they think in a new way, right? And you think the next revolution or the next wave of, we'll say the next wave of AI technology is agentic AI, right? It's the next moving beyond generative AI and how you actually get reasoning behind it. But there's plenty of companies out there telling us, saying we're doing agentic AI, we're using it, we have an agentic AI solution, whatever that might be, whatever way they're framing it up. I've seen from a vendor side of thing, looking at vendors and AI companies that want to sell some type of product to folks, I've only come across two companies, and if you can think of the thousands of AI companies out there that are truly, truly, truly understanding how to implement an agentic AI solution, what a true agentic AI solution is, because I think a lot of people are mislabeling predictive analytics as agentic solutions, and that's not the case, right? And, you know, it's...
We're getting into that area where marketing hype is starting to take precedence over technical accuracy. I mean, we have it consistently happen in technology. You know, it's like, you know, I started off in service-oriented architecture early on, right? And in the beginning, it was all about business services. It was a design. It was an architecture. It's service-oriented architecture. And yet it became about the implementation requirements of SOA, and it destroyed it. It's like, oh yeah, you know, SOA is this, and it's the IBM implementation with these. No, you know, today, you know, cloud native, it's all about Kubernetes and how it runs. And I'm like, it's not about the landing zone. It's about the architecture. We lose the architecture because it's overshadowed by the people who want to make a buck off of it. And that's the reality of it.
Well, like you said, it's a marketing exercise on both sides of the ball. The vendor wants to market themselves so they can sell a product and also I think sometimes, like you said, companies are hungry to be able to put out that press release to say, we're doing something with AI. We want to show shareholder value by saying we're embracing this and we're leveraging it. So don't worry, you don't have to come tell us to do it. We're doing it on our own, right? But again, I think what you're seeing is it's still in its infancy for a lot of folks. I think in the manufacturing space, right, with a highly competitive nature, you have a lot of companies that have to figure out really fast how they are going to efficiently and accurately apply these types of technologies, specifically around, we'll say AI and agentic AI, from the power of the reasoning side, the ability for these systems to make decisions so much quicker than you and I can.
True. Right? And, you know, speaking of which, just, you'll find this interesting given your job. Andrej Kapathy, who was the head of AI for Tesla for a while, and spoke at the Y Combinator conference yesterday, and it's online. He actually talked about an abstraction of software 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, where 3.0 is now the program that you write is the prompt that is dynamically configuring a neural net, right? But he compared it to a electric grid. And he talked about how AI is comparative to an electric grid. And you may want to go out there and look at that given your background and what you do for a living, because the analogy is really interesting from a, you know, he also undoes what he says, or he gives a different analogy that kind of undoes it. But he talks very much about, I think he may have said, he took Andrew Ng's quote, AI is the new electricity. Right. And so he took that one step further to talk about how it compares to building the grid. Right. And so, yeah, I mean, it's is it becoming that, you know, we can't live without electricity. Right. And and the grid is, you know, for a business like one that you work for, supplying power and energy. Right. If you fail, people are in trouble. I mean, there's severe pain. People can get by for a day, maybe even two, I know. And then people start to have to think about things like generators and running that, because long term, without electricity, you know, you start to end up in dangerous situations, right? So, I mean, you're in many regards, an environment that supplying lifeblood to people, right? So.
Well, you think just like it is, you know, with the concept of electricity, right? The concept that we have to take as a utility, right? We have to have that 99.999 and forever 9% uptime, because our customers expect when they turn the light switch on, that the lights come on. And it's something that it's almost like breathing air, right? You don't realize it's not there until it's not there, right? Because you almost take it for granted. But if you think of the words powered by, and how many software, how many pieces of hardware now are using the words powered by AI, powered by Microsoft AI, powered by OpenAI, powered by Anthropic, you know, you think of it just like an electric grid, that if one day, for whatever reason, right, one of these AI providers decides to turn off powered by AI, how many systems will not work?
It's actually happened by act. It's been more of a scalability issue, but yeah, I mean, a couple of them have had outages, we did in the cloud in the early days. And this I expect to have far more outages more often, because the scalability of doing a non-deterministic action that you have no guarantee, no understanding of how long it might take or might not take is, you know, if, and right now I think it's the biggest issue with regard to this. I mean, to me, what you do and what your company does is a very deterministic thing, right? So you're finding uses for a non-deterministic agent within a very, very deterministic business.
Well, yeah, could you think of it too? It's like, not that we don't have a say in it, but we're required to provide power to customers, right? Like we don't have control over that. Now you think of something that's these AI companies out there, who holds the control in the reasoning behind it, right?
It's commercial.
If they want to restrict control one day to a company or a subset or a country or whatever they might choose, like, do they have the ability to do so? Is it going to be controlled by the government? Is it going to be something that's going to be left open so no one has control over it? Because, I mean, think of as we see AI built into more and more systems, more and more processes across businesses and in our personal life as well. If for a full day, no one had internet access in this country, think about it. For one full day, What could you do? Your phone doesn't work. You can't watch, you can't stream. Half the people that don't have a cable line, they don't stream. If we stream TV shows and videos, kids can't play online games. Okay, so we're just talking about creature comforts at this point. Now let me go to a store and try to buy something. But their point of sale systems don't work.
Typically, no.
So does somebody pull out a notepad and say, hey, I can take cash and I'm going to write stuff down? Probably not. Right? So my Google Maps doesn't work for me, right? I can't call people because I'm trying to use voice over data, right? Like,
yeah, we have no backups. We have no backup systems.
But we've come so far as that, like, and that's something, again, Wi-Fi is something we don't think of people having, you know, control over, right? It's almost looked at as a commodity item like power, like water, right? But you think of these AI systems and who at the top level line, right, has the governance over these? Right. Who has
it's scary in the U.S., right? Because now they're saying they want to put legislation or they pass legislation. I'm not sure where it's at that says we're not going to regulate this for 10 years. A utility like electric is it's a regulated industry and it's regulated for a reason. And now you're going to say AI, which really has very much the markers of being a utility, is not going to be regulated for 10 years. I mean, it's very scary to think about people starting to build businesses on this. I mean, you know, you're taking a huge risk and the risk is almost forced. It's like, if I don't do it, I'll get squashed by those who are using it while it's available. But the minute those people who made that bet on that technology and it's not available, they're screwed.
Right. No, I think if you look at like the crypto market, right? Crypto was built as an unregulated banking institution or something to that effect. I won't act like I'm a crypto expert by any means, but as you see, some people would argue that the crypto, you know, exchange is becoming more regulated in some senses. But could you imagine if it became as regulated as our banking industry is? It would lose the inherent value that people appreciate about the crypto market, right?
And it adds the overhead that it supposedly takes away, which is
right. So yeah, no, I think in one sense, you know, no regulations, no governance for 10 years, right? Because you want to continue to drive the innovation, right? That makes sense to me. We want to continue to stay innovative in this space, you know, right, especially in our country and everything. But we set up these governance programs inside our companies, right? You know, AI governance is a big deal for us in maturity level for a lot of these companies as they start on their AI journeys or they're midway down their AI journeys, right? Having an AI governance standpoint and not just employing that, but having your senior leadership understand the AI governance model and the ability to understand these AI, you know, systems. Yeah, I don't know what that does or what that will mean and how that will shape out over the next few years. Like, on one hand, you want to drive the technology advancement, but on the other hand, you allow these companies to maintain control. And for a period of time, that could be good. But again, I think we know with power comes great responsibility.
I hope the business leaders, you know, take that approach of this is great, but you know, I don't want us dependent on it in order to deliver our service, right? So and that is a key part of the governance. Until there's, you know, more assurances, I wouldn't bet the farm on it. I'd want to leverage it if it's available, use it as a, you know, as a capability. And the minute it's gone, I still want to be able to operate and be able to do what my business does. And I think that that's going to become harder and harder, right? Because, you know, take supply chain as an example. If you're, you know, if you build in the AI to make decisions about your, how you're buying or how you're procuring or how you're the logistics behind things, and all of a sudden it's gone, you know, what do you do? What's your fallback position? You got to throw people in there, but the people are probably gone now. The knowledge on how to do that manually is gone now. You've removed those people from the process because you felt like, you know, A, you wanted to reduce the cost of that process, and B, you found something that you thought replaced it. What do you do when it goes wrong, right? I guess you go in a war room and you figure it out, but you're certainly going to be dealt the blow.
No, I think it's like, you see the space evolving, right? And we look at OpenAI, right? Sam Altman's, you know, when OpenAI was founded in 2015, right? Open source, nonprofit, wanted to ensure the AI benefits could go to all of humanity. I think that was like their vision. I don't want to say tagline, but their vision, right? Something in the sense of, I think Sam was quoted in saying, like, we want to build a safe AI,
right,
and share broadly the benefits. Well, I think we've seen over time that open mindset has now shifted into what I would call, or what I think some people would call, a cautiously closed model. All right, we see that in ChatGPT-4, not open source, right? So given, I think, now what you're seeing in this now where AI systems have become more of a competitive landscape, I don't think we can argue that it's, you know, you look at OpenAI, DeepSeek, Anthropic, you're still with Google, Amazon, and Apple are trying to do, right, these large companies, and there's 10 others. Now I think you're looking at these systems, instead of being open, they're assuming there's going to be more safety implications that, you know, large scale models. So they're looking at this cautiously closed model, or, you know, what I would just say, they're more of a favor of a closed type model.
They're getting harder to regulate internally. I mean, if you read the last document that I think Anthropic put out about the things that they learned in testing, their, you know, the Claude, the Sonnet, the latest version, and the things that it did when they turned stuff on and when they turned stuff off, and how they were able to, you know, circumvent certain things, and certain circuits, you know, that were supposed to close didn't close. And they, you know, they were transparent on all of this. But you start to realize that between the technology cost of building one of these large models and the cost to actually, as they get more complex, train them and validate them, you know, at some point you can't be altruistic about this, right? So it's only normal that a closed model is likely to occur commercially, because we don't live in an altruistic society. We don't have governments funding this. Now, if these were government funded, and I think they should be government funded, and I'm not big on big government, but every government should fund a open AI for their citizens. I mean, it's important. It's important to have that constant, you know, to not be reliant upon investors who want a 10x return controlling the levers of this all important technology for our people. Hey, we're just about out of time, but I want to give you a minute. Why don't you take a couple of minutes and talk about your book and let people know what the book's about? Because I think the audience would find that really interesting.
Oh yeah, so luckily enough to work with some great publishers over at Wiley, you know, to get this book out, that worked really hard on, spent a lot of, you know, what I would say, it's the blood, sweat, and tears of seeing, you know, various industries through the digital transformation, the Industry 4.0 process. But how I look at it is when I was framing up when I wrote this book, right? You know, the first thought was, okay, what does everybody look for in technology? They want an easy button. Okay, well, I can't give everybody an easy button, but I, you know, what I saw as a missing piece for manufacturing industry was what's the playbook look like, right? Like you had to say architect it from top to bottom on how a company would adopt, would scale, would think about the value behind AI in order to grab, you know, to grab the value out of these, you know, AI systems. What I wanted to actually build is, you know, where does AI intersect with industry? So how is Gen AI, when I say Gen AI, I could mean generative or agentic AI, right? But how does Gen AI reshape the future of manufacturing? And everything from, you know, the autonomous design and predictive maintenance to supply chain optimization and the ethical side of deployments of these systems. And it's geared towards C-suite leaders, regional leaders, directors, engineers, innovators, right, that are wanting to drive and trying to drive transformation. And so, you know, inside the book, you know, what I find a lot of people want is use cases. So have a couple where I would say more actionable use cases across key sectors, you know, showing where either I've helped or some great examples out there in industry where I think companies are truly trying to move the needle in niche spaces with AI. Showcase the frameworks for AI adoption and getting that ROI out of these systems. I talk about, you know, the strategic centered human deployment of AI and the strategies behind how you go and do that successfully, and help leaders frame what is that vision of that fully autonomous future of operations inside of manufacturing. And so, you know, my focus is if you're leading the digital transformation efforts, if you're a data scientist, if you're an operations, you know, VP, if you're the C-suite, you're the CIO or CEO, I think it's so important for those leaders to have this in-depth understanding of AI and not just point their direction and say, hey, I have a data science group, they're doing it for me. Or, yeah. Oh, yeah, I understand what AI is. I use ChatGPT, right? But have a true depth of understanding of this technology that I think previously they would have said, I know enough to be dangerous. Well, that's not good enough anymore, right? You have to become that next level down knowledge of this and yeah. How to apply it broadly, right? You got to have that strategy in place, right? It's everything what we need to see inside of companies' visions and goals that are publicly shown, but also it has to be the discussion point now on not just, hey, maybe we should do this, but we have to do this to survive. Right, we're in the midst of transformation for a lot of these companies, and it's not the thing of where you say, well, companies need to transform, like Kodak didn't transform, but Xerox did. But you know, but it's truly to the point to where, in a couple of years, you're going to look to your left and to your right, and if you're not the company that's transforming with AI, and the person to your right is, you're not going to see them anymore because they're going to be so far ahead of you, you won't be able to play catch up anymore. And it's truly when manufacturing industry, it's going to enable people to obtain market share because how efficient they're going to be able to make decisions at speed and at scale.
It's pretty interesting. Hey, listen, we barely scratched the surface on some of the stuff I wanted to dig into. I would love to have another conversation where you actually, you know, we get a little in the weeds and talk a little bit about, you know, how this stuff actually applies in an implementation, and I hope you'll come back and have that conversation with us.
Oh no, yeah, no, JP. I think there's 101 topics we could go different avenues we can go down this path. I think like we stayed high level a little bit. But yes, yeah, no, I think you know what we're doing here, what AI is enabling us to do, right? We're reducing degrees of separation and increasing access to data and what that means for us on so many levels. But yeah, no, I'd love to talk to get into a little bit more in the weeds on applicable use cases of, you know, how you think about these things. And again, with any technology, right? I always tell people it's don't get focused on the technology piece, right? Don't get focused on the shiny, the sexy widget, right? That does XYZ for you. It's really about what you understand what's the hardest part of rolling out technology. Well, it's people. It's the people we have and how we have to change how they work and how they have to embrace and use the technology to be successful. And that change process is always the hardest piece of technology rollout.
There is that case here. I also think that in this particular case, there is a technological hurdle. I think building scalable AI-based models is not a simple task. It is fraught with pitfalls and that people haven't even explored building this and deploying it at scale. So some interesting projects going on in that realm, but yeah. Hey, again, thank you for joining, and I look forward to doing this again soon.
You bet. No, JP, thank you again. I can't wait to talk to you soon.
Take care.